Item number 17, annual update of the status of submerged aquatic vegetation. Dr. Bob Orth of VIMS. Hey, Bob. Sorry it took a while.
Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to make my annual presentation. Given what's going on, I'll try to go through my comments fairly quickly, as I have in the past. What I'd like to do today is cover a number of topics in this presentation. One is to first give you an update on the baywide SAB status and in particular focus on eelgrass, which is our dominant species in the lower bay and one of concern because of its function as a crab habitat. Again, second point would be an update on the SAB sanctuary in Chincoteague Bay. Third item would be the issue with propeller scarring. Again, an update based on the funding that we get from you every year. Fourth item, just to touch base very briefly on aquaculture issues. And the last major item would be to, again, give you an update on our seagrass restoration in the coastal bays and some exciting work that we've now embarked on with Mark Lucan back from the Eastern Shore. And just to wrap it up on where our funding comes from so you understand how all this functions within the Commonwealth. So, with that, what's happening with SAB in the Chesapeake Bay, what I've got in this figure, based on the mapping, you know, we have a program where we keep our fingers on the pulse of all the grass beds in the bay by conducting aerial photography every single year, produce a report, so we know where every single grass bed is every single year. And what we're showing you here in this graphic is from 1984 through 2008, the total number of acres of SAB in the bay. And then this is the bay, and this shows essentially the yellow is where the grass beds are. Over this time frame from 84 through 2008, the total SAB has increased about twofold. But there is a goal that has been established by the Chesapeake Bay Program and approved by the Executive Council, which are the governors of the state and various dignitaries. They're essentially your bosses, my bosses. They're the people that really make a lot of the key enforcement regulations around the bay. They have set up a goal of 185,000 acres or 75,000 hectares, because I have this in hectares, and we're far below that goal. I mean, that's no news. This has been going on for years, but we're far below the goal that they would like to establish for the Chesapeake Bay. And this goal was based on examination of historical photographs where grass beds used to occur late as the 1960s and 70s. So anyway, that's an important point to keep in mind. However, when I show you these numbers, the fact is that the bay is very complex and a lot of things going on within the bay that vary by region and by segment. So what I've commented here is that this total coverage really masks some of the complex changes that occur, notably those occurring in the upper bay and the mid bay. And I wanted to point out those in my next slide. What I have here is the Chesapeake Bay broken down by salinity areas, which is in color, the blue being the fresh tidal freshwater and low salinity areas, the green being the mid-bay or mesohaline areas of medium salinity, 5 to maybe 15 to 18 parts per thousand, and their high salinity. And then the number of hectares that we've mapped from 84 through 2008 in each of these zones. The first thing that will jump out is what's been happening in the low salinity or tidal freshwater areas. We've seen this dramatic increase in abundance of plants in the freshwater areas. And this is actually being driven by what's happening up here at the head of the bay, the Susquehanna Flats, which historically supported a huge amount of SAB. It all declined after Agnes has been revegetating very rapidly. And it's one of the biggest waterfowl areas in the bay. And this is actually driving this curve, why we see this big increase. But we're also seeing increases in this part of the Potomac, and some of our tributaries, for example, the Pamunkey, Mattapani, and Chickahominy, and some of the smaller tributaries in the James. And while we haven't seen anything in the main stem James, that may not be too far off, because one of the main species that seems to be colonizing the freshwater areas happens to be an invasive hydrilla. And while hydrilla is a nasty plant in many reservoirs in some of our tributaries, it actually provides some of the same functions as all the native species. Now, some people may not like it. For example, the Potomac River, where they do harvest it to provide access to marinas and some local properties, is providing key habitat. So we are seeing, you know, a growth of this invasive what's interesting is that in addition to this invasive, we're now seeing some of the native plants come in. So this has been a big surprise of what's been happening over the last few years. What's driving this, we've done some analysis, and it seems to be related to the reduction in nitrogen loads coming in from the watersheds. So some of the efforts to reduce nitrogen may be playing, you know, a major role in why we're seeing this in tidal fresh and low salinity areas. The mid-bay is an enigma. This area used to support a variety of species, namely eelgrass, widgeon grass, redhead grass. We now only have one species, widgeon grass. And this is a boom or bust species. And while we were excited about what was going on here, these dynamics have been driven by one species. And you'll see in my next slide, while I finish here, lack of diversity is what's really causing some of these major shifts that are occurring here. And we're concerned that while we were increasing, we're plateauing out and going back to very low levels that were occurring in the bay in the late 80s. And then last but not least, the high salinity areas. This is where eelgrass and widgeon grass dominate. Part of this graphic is what I showed you last year. Our concern is, while we initially were excited about this increase, the long-term trend since the early 90s has been a downward trend. And while we're seeing these peaks, the overall trend seems to be a downward trend. That concerns us. How this relates to eelgrass, this is kind of embedded in what I showed you last year, but this big, big polygon is where eelgrass used to occur in the late 60s, early 70s. This part of the polygon that's surrounded by these dotted lines are the upriver, upbay historic limits. We do not see any eelgrass in most of these areas right now. It's essentially gone, except for a few localized spots. Most of our eelgrass now exists here. Here are that data from 84 through 2007. It's a separate layer, and we don't have the 2008 data yet, but it essentially says, you know, we're losing eelgrass in the lower Chesapeake Bay since the 90s. Chincoteague Bay is, again, a story I showed you last year. We had a dramatic increase in Chincoteague from the 80s through 2001. Now that's dropped off the cliff and we have low levels. It's a water quality issue. Our coastal bays, which I'll highlight toward the end of the talk, it's a very different story and one of the success stories that we have in terms of seagrass restoration, not just here locally, but probably nationwide and worldwide. So this is a concern of what we're seeing here in the Chesapeake. I showed you this slide last year because I know, Rick, you raised a question about the clarity. This is the Secchi readings that have been happening within the Chesapeake Bay over this time frame, and you asked the question, well, what's going on? Over the last year, there's been an emerging interest in a lot of scientists as what's going on. A really interesting article that came out in the magazine Chesapeake Quarterly that talks about what may be happening, and it's really almost a paradigm shift in terms of the water clarity. Maybe driven by increasing nutrients, but there's also a lot of things going on within the bay in terms of loss of benthic habitat that would have certain types of animals that would sequester nutrients, clams, worms that burrow into the bottom and sequester things. Most of the productivity now is occurring in the water column, which is probably fueling a very different system of particles as a particle size. And again, this is what really is bothering us, because this downward trend may be very difficult to reverse in the short term. And the grass beds that we've been losing in the Chesapeake Bay, as I've mentioned, are the deep water areas, the ones that are going to need the most light and the ones that go first. And again, it is a concern that is appearing in a number of articles. And again, the SOX continues. It's a challenge, and I'll keep you updated every year what's going on. I'll take care of that. What I wanted to highlight in this last part of the first section about these water quality standards, last year I mentioned that SAB is now part of the water quality standards in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where we are looking at improvements in the bay water quality based on how much SAB there is, as well as water clarity. And this report is now out by the DEQ, which talks about essentially all these requirements being met or not met, the attainment. And this report goes to, again, you know, our governors and all the people that are making the right decisions. There is obviously a lot of effort to try to improve the water quality of the bay. It's not easy, but we have standards that have been adopted that include now SAB. So my comment was, every acre for SAB counts, because they're using these acres for attainment. And not attaining these standards may mean some more difficult issues ahead for the Commonwealth of Virginia that could be very expensive. More on that next year. Okay, the Chincoteague SAB Sanctuary, again, an update, because started back in the 90s with these scars that were caused by watermen dredging for clams in these grass beds. We adopted a sanctuary that protected these grass beds in Virginia, all the green areas surrounded by a little margin with markers. Here are the data since that time period when we first established the sanctuary. We had some problems because it wasn't marked. We marked it, and I think that really made a big difference. You can see almost no scarring. We had a little bit in 2007. That we saw none in 2008. So I think overall that the sanctuary has been effective. And I'd like to thank your enforcement people that make a big difference.
We did use that, as you know, when I was in enforcement, we used that as a benchmark for the job that we were doing up on the Eastern Shore.
Right.
The question I've got is, there was a couple of years the signs were gone.
Yep, they're gone.
They're gone.
And we've been working with Hank and his staff. They're putting up white markers that we've alerted people to what they are.
Well, now they should know where.
And the thing is, these signs are very expensive, $2,000 a pole. And so in working with Hank and his staff, it's worked out well. The dredge season is only from December 1st to March 15th, so it's a short time period. And again, the number of people that dredge for clams, I think, are not that many anyway. So I think it's been a very effective plan. So for that. The propeller scarring issue, again, attributed to the hull safety. We have focused on monitoring this at two sites, what we call the Browns Bay site, just here at the mouth of the York River, and the Pocosin site. While they occur in other areas, we focus most of our attention in monitoring the current scarring and what happens to the scarring over time. This is the Browns Bay site in 1997, and what alerted us to the issue. All this is the grass, and all these are the scars caused by the propellers from the boats that were hauling for fish. These are the data that I show you every year. By looking at our aerial photographs, we measure the length of every single scar that we see each year, and then we follow that scar in subsequent years so we can monitor the report. Here is 1997, when we saw all these scars in that previous picture. We found that scars recover very quickly when we adopted the resolution that minimizes the depth that they can haul. And by, I think, just bringing attention to the matter, the number of scars and the length have decreased over time. And while there is some scarring, you can see that the length of the scars that we see each year is very much reduced. So I think, again, just by public information working with people, I think it's worked really well. Again, there's some scarring, but I think it's minimal compared to what was a real serious problem back in the 90s. These are the Pocosin flats. Again, this was when we brought the issue to the commission. These scars recover fast because here's one year, there's the next year. And I think that really helped us understand that, again, some scarring can be allowed, but you don't want to have a lot because the basis of these beds depends on having some existing grass around it. So here's our 2008 data. Again, some scarring that we've noticed, but it's not a major issue as we saw in the previous years. And we try to, again, work with your staff because here's a spot where we've been spending an awful lot of time and money trying to restore eel grass in plots. This is the Coast Guard area of the New York River. And through some of our restoration efforts, one of the things that we're finding that in working with seed, because there's so little grass around, and because the dynamics of these systems have changed so much, it's turning out that we're finding that some of these restoration sites need to be enhanced every single year. So what we've established in the Yorktown area are these half-acre plots, in which some plots we seed every year, other plots we just seed once and then watch what happens. So these three plots are reseeded. The concern we're having is that these are propeller scars going through these restored plots. And I've alerted Jack to this issue that we need to address this particular problem. It is an area where haul centers occur. It's a very shallow water area. There has been grass back in the late 60s and 70s. We've been having great success and been learning a lot. It's frustrating to see that happen to these well-established plots in which we spend a lot of time, put a lot of seeds, a lot of effort, and it's money that's being spent. And so I'd like to think we can work with Jack and his crew to identify and work with the guys to minimize that, because we see it every year. I just hate to see all that effort kind of go dug out. And what's happening, you see these patches outside these plots. Again, they're starting to spread, something like what we've been seeing in the coastal bays. And we're seeing patches well outside the plots. We think that, again, once we get well-established dense beds, that they provide the propagules seeds to these adjacent areas. But you've got to minimize the disturbance. I mean, you can't spread everything, but I think, again, working with your staff and trying to come up with a plan might help. So we'll see where that goes next year. Okay, the aquaculture issues, you know, in 1998, you all approved a regulation that said no new permits in existing areas of grass. In the last year, we have worked, just to give you an update, very closely with your staff. When an application comes before the staff, if it occurs in areas where there is eelgrass or grass, they usually call us and ask us, you know, our opinion. And so far, in all the permits that have been dealt with, we've worked out appropriate compromises in areas that have had grass. So, for example, today I met with Hank, and we went through a couple of requests, one of which was from a gentleman on the Eastern Shore, looked at the photos, worked out a compromise that he'll go back, that this will not have to come before the commission. Again, there are a variety of these permits. For example, the Chincoteague Bay, there was a request in an area that we actually mapped as a dense grass bed, but it turned out that it was a shell pile, and we mapped around it. So I met with Paul Rogers. We looked at it. We felt, hey, it's not a problem. The gentleman wanted to use the area that would not have grass. And again, you know, we resolve these issues by talking and coming up with compromises. So with regard to permits, you know, if there's an area where it's close to grass, we try to work with the permit holder, and if it's not approved, again, you know, make some adjustments. So I think the regulation that was approved in 1990 seems to be working when the permits go through the proper process. So that's it for aquaculture.
I think some of the biggest concern from what I hear from the aquaculturists, especially on the Eastern Shore, are those established clam beds where seagrass may be migrating, which is a good thing, but at the same time, they do have a concern that, you know, the possibility of losing good ground is present.
Well, they have, you know, a permit that allows them to work a certain area, and I know they move their nets around, and as far as I understand, they're allowed to do that even if grass occurs within that permit. And when they move their nets from one spot to another, more than likely that spot that has just been vacated because they can't plant clams and such as use, that gets colonized. So, you know, as long as we have robust populations in and around some of these permits, I think we're okay. And again, I think the best thing is, again, when these issues arise that we talk about and come up with an appropriate compromise, you know, to deal with it. And I know there are some other issues that we're working on, but I like to think that, you know, by working together, you know, we'll be able to, you know, deal with these issues in a gentlemanly fashion.
Works a lot better.
The last area is, again, giving you an update on seagrass restoration in the coastal lagoons. These coastal lagoons historically supported some really dense grass beds. Up until 1932, with the Big 33 storm, everything was gone. Supported big abundances of bay scallops. You've been kind enough to allow us to work in some set-aside areas, and there's also a fair amount of public ground that we've been using. We've been using volunteers to use to collect seeds, because that's the way we've been restoring these beds. It's worked out really well in working with the Nature Conservancy. We have, you know, 50 to 80 volunteers that come out now in the spring to help us in the seeds. The graphic of what we've been doing, we've been, since about 2001, broadcasting roughly 25 million seeds in this line here, about 208 acres that we've actually okay. Since this time, that has spread to over about 2,500 acres where we mapped that. These are mapped areas with seagrass. This magenta line basically says, okay, of all those mapped areas, if you squished all of it into an area, how much continuous coverage would you have? And so we're looking at about 800 acres of just really dense areas. And this is brought up in this particular picture. This is Wreck Island. This is, again, aerial photographs where we can use to document where the grass beds are. This red outline shows much of our set-aside that's over there. These are these plots of 1 acre that we put seeds in, and this is a 2004 shot. In 4 years, these areas now have become essentially dense, continuous bed. You know, when the water quality is not an issue, and you have these dense areas, they spread everywhere, and it happens overnight. So we've been really pleased, and again, you know, we still try to be very cautious because, you know, what happens in one day can be gone the next, as happened in the 32 time period. So we're very encouraged, and you know, we know there are going to be some emerging issues with regard to conflict resolution, and I like to think again that we'll be able to work through those with some of those issues that deal with aquaculture, because there is a lot of aquaculture occurring in all these areas. Now, this is an interesting picture. I think I might have highlighted to you that we put all of our data on Google Earth that you can find out where all the grass beds are. So here's the Eastern Shore. This is South Bay. This is Cobb Bay, Spirecraft, and Hog Island Bay. So these are the four big bays that had eelgrass in the 30s. The green areas, again, are areas that we've mapped from our aerial photography. So you can see the extent to which they've grown. All these green areas on the bayside are eelgrass beds. So you can just see the extent of these areas that had grass in the 30s. So what we're looking at, and I'll give you the data first, you know, there was a very viable scallop fishery on the coastal bays in the late 20s up until 1932, and these are the numbers of pounds of bay scallops harvested during these five time periods that we had data. And that's a lot of meat. This is shucked meat. These are, you know, the meats coming from that. Here is the value that accrued to those pounds harvested during those time periods. And this would be the value that those scallops would have if you were dealing with today's dollars. I just use a converter that's available on the web. So in 1929, I mean, that's a lot of scallops harvested, you know, during that time period. So it was a very productive fishery and basically disappeared when the eelgrass disappeared. So what we've established this year is a very small program where we're beginning to see whether we can actually reestablish the bay scallop into these coastal bays. We have put out roughly 5,000, and this is where we're working with Mark Newton back on Eastern Shore, where he's going to raise the bay scallop. So we're hoping that this is going to work. We're still dealing with an amount of eelgrass that is far below what was historically that would support these. But we wanted to get a head start to see what we can even do this. So we're essentially introducing juvenile bay scallops to different seasons. This, if we want to start doing the restoration, we want to know is it better to put it in the summer or fall? What sizes do we put out? It's much more expensive to put adults because they're more expensive, very inexpensive than if we work with juveniles. So we're doing all this, and this is our first set that was put out about a month ago, and we're putting another in replicated plots. And again, I'll keep you updated on what happens with this particular project. It's very exciting to think, you know, maybe, you know, there'll be this other phase where we can reestablish this, and then what happens? Well, that would be an interesting story in itself. If we ever get these back, what do we do next? That would be a fun problem to have. So, and last, our funding. The monitoring that we do that does all of the mapping from aerial photography and all that, you know, we receive funds, major source from EPA. We get some money from the DQ, NOAA, which supports both Maryland and Virginia, and we get some money from Maryland. It's truly a bay-wide project, and we get lots of sources that make this happen every single year. And the rest of the SAV restoration issues we get, and a lot of our money initially came from the Recreational Fishing License Fund. They've been very, very supportive of our work. When we've gotten federal money, we've minimized our request from them. And so right now the big source of funds is coming from NOAA. We've received money from the Nature Conservancy, Army Corps, and some private funds. But right now it's these two groups that are really providing kind of the source of funds. The Seaside Project has actually gotten some stimulus money, you know, because NOAA has received some of that money. And we applied, and we're the only project in the state of Virginia that received money from NOAA as part of the stimulus package. And I think that's it. So my summary, basically water quality still remains the major driver for SAB in the Chesapeake Bay. That is going to be on the table for a long time to come. Chincoteague Sanctuary, no scarring, but the water quality in Chincoteague has been remaining an issue since we saw things go down since 2001. Scarring, low levels, but we got to keep monitoring. I know Jack is going to make the request that we keep the funding at its current level for the next year. Coastal bays, you know, it's a dream to have a project where things are working so well. And again, we're doing more than just restoration. We are monitoring the water quality, so we're keeping our fingers on what's driving these populations and comparing that to what happens in the Chesapeake Bay. So we've got really great side-by-side comparisons. And so we're able to at least say, hey, if we want to do this in the Chesapeake the way it is in the coastal base, you know, this is what you got to do. And then our next question, our base scallops next. And that's pretty much it. So
thanks for the conference report. Anybody have any questions? I've got one, Bob. You know, being interested in the SAV, and hypothetically, you said you received funds from X, Y, and Z. If you had twice as much funding, could you then multiply the amount of seagrass, do you think, by that exponential amount? In other words, based on what you've got, if you had double that, could you double that, and do you have the capacity
if we had twice as much funding, we might be able to increase the ability to restore eelgrass by not just double, but perhaps quadruple or even an order of
magnitude. Exponential?
Yeah, I mean, the limitation is getting seeds. And actually, what's interesting, where we're getting all of our seeds are from the coastal bays, which were, all those beds were established with seeds from the Chesapeake Bay. So this year, all the seeds that we collected came from the coastal bays. And we've developed a mechanized machine that can actually harvest a lot of the reproductive seeds. So it's a matter of, you know, we can collect, this year I think we're up around 10 million seeds that we collected. We could collect a lot more than that. These beds produce anywhere between 20 to 200 million seeds per acre. So we're just scratching the surface. So yeah, if we have some additional funds, it would facilitate the restoration of the coastal base. It's happening so fast naturally now that a couple more years, you know, it's going to be pretty impressive. And we could really enhance what we're doing in the Chesapeake, because I think what we're seeing, because populations are so low and they're so isolated in parts of the bay, that it's going to require seeding every single year in a number of areas.
About what are you spending now on the program?
Well, it bounces around because we get funds from a variety of sources. So, for example, the money that we just received from NOAA, which includes the funding for the scallops, the funding for the seaside restoration, and the funding for the water quality for it, roughly 18 to 20 months, it was about $510,000. Now, that's just for the seaside work. If we, you know, look at the big picture on an annual basis, we'll be getting anywhere between $150,000 and $200,000 for the restoration, which includes the water quality monitoring. I mean, we have to do the monitoring, you know, because it doesn't do any good just to put stuff out and not see what happens.
So your whole program right now is $750,000,
$800,000? Well, remember that money from NOAA is going to fund all of Mark's operation. Okay, so there's a significant chunk there. We have a significant chunk that covers all the water quality. And then this is the SAV restoration, which is roughly about $100,000 for 18 months. So, you know, $500,000 from NOAA for roughly about 18 months for three major elements. And then whatever money we have for other bits and pieces fills in what we're doing in the Chesapeake. What we try to do is minimize our requests from the recreational license fund, just because they have so few funds and we have so few staff. You know, we just can't expand exponentially overnight. And I don't think it's fair to try to have funds just because we want money. We try to be really judicious in our requests and do the best we can with what we have. So while we made a request several years ago from the recreational license funds, we've actually made very little impact on those funds because we've had funds from the federal sources.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Mr. Travelstead?
Before we move this agenda item, there is the matter of the request to continue Dr. Orr's monitoring of the scarring situations.
What's that, $20,000?
$20,000.
It's a pleasure of the commission. Mr. Robbins.
Mr. Chairman, consistent with staff recommendation, move approval of funding.
Second by Mr. Tankard and Bowden. So, Mr. Bowden, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thanks, Bob.
If you have ever questions,
you got it.
You're welcome to come out to South Bay and use your stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.